ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
The Sixers 2 minutes away from tying this series. Harden wants to take Strus. Well played. Flicks it up. No. Embiid hit the offensive glass. With a breathtaking pass. Harden together, and he buries it. James Harden, the former league MVP, turning the clock back here in South Philly.
That is the sound of the best night that any Sixers fan has had in weeks. Honestly, months. Possibly a year. And look, I know that it's just one game in a second round playoff series, and I know that Philly is just tied with Miami now, 2-2. But if these NBA playoffs have proven anything, it's that it is totally normal to get deep into your feelings at a moment's notice. So today, Ryan Windhorst talks us through a set of conference semifinals that are overflowing with hard fouls and bad blood in all directions, from Dallas to Milwaukee to the Bay. And he explains how quickly things can go from best to worst. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, May 9th. This is ESPN Daily.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Ryan Windhorst, I am prone to over-celebration. That is one of my flaws as somebody who is invested in the Philadelphia 76ers. So I invite you onto this show to help inject this episode with some objectivity of sorts. So what is the word that you would use to describe what James Harden looked like tonight?
Reanimated. I wish I could say, wow, this is the breakout performance where now this is going to change everything. I don't know, but, you know, he looked light on his feet, you know, getting into that step back three-pointer. He was, you know, doing his three-point celebration, running back down the court. It was, you know, the James Harden that Daryl Morey tried to trade for a year. And whether he came for one night only or he came for the rest of the postseason, if you're a Sixer fan, you've got to love the idea that your team is heading back to Miami with Joel Embiid healthy enough to contribute at a high level and James Harden with the first shreds of real momentum since the trade happened.
Yeah, no, reanimation, resurrection, all of that feels appropriate, both for James Harden, who had 31, 9, and 7 in this game, and also just for people who were rooting for this team, Brian. I mean, the idea of brokenness, that was the story of the Sixers postseason. And the Harden end of things, and I am reveling in this so much. I was emotional watching this, Brian. James Harden has become like an underdog. Somehow, like the guy who's about to make a Supermax extension, whatever it is, $50+ million a year. We were sort of like lamenting the fact that, God, they're going to have to pay him that. And somehow he emerges out of this as like this scrappy underdog story. I felt it watching him regain what felt very clearly like confidence.
Well, you could call it an underdog. Other people could call it a lowering of expectations. but this is what the Sixers envisioned when they made their long run to try to get him. And during one of the three-pointers that he made in the fourth quarter, Joel Embiid was on the bench at the time, and his reaction was not just celebration, but of like relief. You could see that he was just like, this, you could almost read his thoughts. This is what we were talking about. And, you know, obviously it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take a high level analysis to realize that if the Sixers have two players, Harden and Embiid, playing at that level, they take on a completely different complexion. But, you know, there's still a lot more work to do, and I'm not yet convinced, but James will always have this one, no matter how the rest of the series goes.
There's a lot of tape of me sprinkling dirt on the grave of James Harden as I've been watching him these playoffs, right? And because his vertical leap might be like 2 inches right now, Brian, to be clear. Like the idea of his body, something is different. But in terms of the mentality, the psychology of like him just feeling himself again, I just wonder like what did he see out of the Miami Heat that made him feel that way?
I mean, he had a good three-point shooting night. He was 6 of 10 on threes. He still only took 18 official shots, which it was about his average as a net. So, you know, there was a time when this game would have been around an average Harden game. And that's not to downplay it, because it's not an average Harden game now.
No.
Now it's an outstanding Harden game.
Now it's the greatest
game.
James Harden playoff performance in right. Philadelphia 76ers history.
You know, but here's the thing. Like, I say it's an average Harden game, or was. It's not actually, because it's not like, even though James has literally hundreds of games like this in his career on his resume, he doesn't have lots of games in the playoff like this on his career. You know, in this situation, I mean, it wasn't technically an elimination game, but you go down 3-1, where two of the remaining three are in Miami, you're pretty much done. So for Harden to deliver this type of performance in this game is relevant. It doesn't wash away, you know, dark marks on his, you know, on his playoff resume. But if this is the beginning of a run for him, it could completely change the conversation around him heading into his contract year. There's a lot of ifs in that sentence, though.
It sounds like you would advise James Harden to walk right into Daryl Morey's office and be like, never forget what happened here tonight when you offer me that contract.
And I would advise Daryl Morey to say, James, great game. Let's go get another one, and agree to nothing.
Well, look, part of the reason why there are these vibes around this team tonight, Brian, is because Joel Embiid, by the way, like, this was supposed to be the story, is Joel Embiid's return in game three. He was a force of nature, right? A torn thumb ligament, the mask on. He had been concussed. He has a fractured face thanks to that Pascal Siakam elbow that he suffered. He was amazing in game three. In game four, he doesn't score at all in the fourth quarter, but instead Joel Embiid is sort of riding sidecar to James Harden. And I wonder what you think Joel looks like right now, as you've now seen him in these two games back from this injury.
I've covered a number of players in my career that have this exact same thumb injury, and it is an auto surgery, Pablo. Players can't grip the ball. Maybe you learn how to sort of manage the limitations on it over the course of time. So maybe you'll improve a little bit. And I think he has, but for him to be able to play on this injury is significant, and it gets forgotten about because it's several weeks old and people are used to seeing him play with it. But that thumb injury is significant. And then I will tell you that I have never covered a player, with maybe the exception of Rip Hamilton, who didn't absolutely hate playing in a mask. I have seen numerous players helicopter masks off their face over to the bench area because they hate it so much. The people around the team expected him to come back in game three. They couldn't say that because then if he didn't, it would look like he had failed. But they know who he is. They know what he was willing to do. And once he found out he didn't have to have surgery on his face, he was like, I'm going to come back as fast as I can. And I don't know if it's going to be enough, but at least Harden's stepping forward in game four that removed the burden from him a little bit.
Yeah, and Embiid as like the number one guy on this team, he has 24 and 11 to his credit. And it seems like just everybody in the starting lineup tonight for the Sixers was in double digits, right? But when Embiid is on the floor, the entire gravitational field in the game changes. And I'm not saying that, you know, they are necessarily winning because DeAndre Jordan isn't playing in these last two games. He's played 0 minutes and they've won two games. I'm not making that argument, but I'm saying it doesn't feel entirely coincidental that they have been relying on a very, very cliff-sized drop-off when they have to go to their bench.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think about floor spacing in the modern era, think about players playing on the perimeter and pulling their defenders away from the basket, thereby allowing more room inside for drives or to let big men operate. In the case of Embiid, it was the inverse. His presence in the interior pulled the defenders away from the perimeter. And it is not a coincidence that the instant Joel came back, that Danny Green had his best shooting night in a while, made 7 of 9 threes. That, you know, reality is something that you hold on to as you go to try to now play a 3-game series with 2 of the 3 in Florida.
I return now to those 3-point shooting numbers, because as good as the Sixers were tonight, basically making 50% of them from beyond the arc, the Miami Heat, Brian, this statistic I just came across, over the last two games now, they have missed 51 of their last 65 3-point attempts. And I think part of that is, yeah, the Sixers' defense, great job. But another part of it just seems like, I don't know, someone has a voodoo doll somewhere. So what feels sustainable to you about what you saw out of the Miami Heat offense in game four?
Well, the Heat, they have a lot of things going for them, but one of the things that they have struggled with really throughout the season, and even last season, is that they are not a quote-unquote great half-court offensive team. They really rely on transition, their defense fueling their offense, and it's one of the reasons why Tyler Herro is so important to them. One of the reasons why he won Sixth Man of the Year and why they need him is because he is really their best creator in the half court. And so he had a great first couple of games in this series. And the Sixers, and you know, Doc Rivers has gotten criticized routinely throughout his career for not being so great at in-series adjustments. Well, he made a significant in-series adjustment here and began trapping Tyler Herro to force the ball out of his hands. And, Eric Spoelstra, the Miami Heat coach, you know, his preparation across the board, from lineups to the way he operates during the season to prepare his team for adversity, you would never, ever call Eric Spoelstra unprepared or an Eric Spoelstra team unprepared. But they were seemingly a little caught off guard about, you know, when that happened. And even he said, we kind of have to dust off the rust, or, you know, knock off the rust on how to handle Tyler Herro double teams. And he wasn't, even after having a couple of days to prepare for it, you know, that wasn't any better, in this game.
Four for 12. Yeah. For Tyler Herro. Yeah.
And only 11 points. I mean, they've got, you know, their record is tremendous when he scores over 20 points, and, you know, they lose by 8 and he has 11. He has a 20-point game. I don't have to do the math for you. It makes a big difference. So, and Kyle Lowry, who is their point guard, he is laboring on a hamstring injury. If this was the regular season, he wouldn't be playing.
He was shut out in game three. He had 6 points, 3 for 10 from the floor in game four.
Right. You know, and in this game also, Bam Adebayo had some foul trouble. So, they're just not a resilient offensive team. And Eric Spoelstra has elected to play a team that is better defensively, which has taken Duncan Robinson, who's a hot and cold shooter, but certainly a guy who can change your fortunes with his offense. He is not in the rotation and hasn't been for a while. And really, you rely a heavy amount on Jimmy Butler to sort of be your savior.
Who, by the way, Brian, like tonight, almost did it. You know, they lost by 8. Jimmy Butler had 40. He was 13 of 20 from the field, 12 of 13 from the free throw line. He was transcendent.
Yeah, I mean, that type of performance that Jimmy had in the half court, quite frankly, is the type of game that Harden used to have regularly. Maybe not in the playoffs, but in the regular season, where he could just create so much on his own without much help. And if he wasn't scoring straight up, he was getting fouled and going to the line. That was a classic sort of Harden type performance that that Butler put out there. And he just didn't have much help.
No. So James Harden goes from point guard to some version of the hybrid that we remember him as. And the series is now alive, Brian. But the other series that I had figured might have been over by now is, of course, the Mavericks and the Suns. And so I want to get to that with you, because Dallas earlier on Sunday beats Phoenix in Dallas, 111-101. And the Mavericks and Luka Doncic have now won two pretty stunning games in a row at home to tie this series. And I think, like, we got to start with the fact that, as impressive as Dallas has been, that Chris Paul fouled out of this game with about 9 minutes left in the fourth quarter after struggling with foul trouble himself the entire time.
I mean, I guess that Chris Paul's probably had maybe some games like this in his life. I never remember seeing it. And, you know, the final foul itself, it was a questionable call on whether you'd actually foul Chris Paul out on that type of play. But,
yeah,
you know, most of the fouls were fouls.
He wasn't really complaining after them in the game either, like after he was committing them.
Chris Paul's decision-making is elite amongst elite. If you were not a Chris Paul fan, you would say that he got hoisted on his own petard with some of the maneuvers that ended up causing fouls, like Luka Doncic maybe embellishing an over the back, but he did hit mm-hmm. him. Jalen Brunson trying to bait him into a backcourt foul, and it, you know, the referee turning around and stunningly calling it on Chris for an offensive foul. Chris has done that play for years. And so maybe it was a little bit of karma, but certainly a very unusual set of circumstances. And it was combined with several Dallas role players having great games, and that is how you get beat in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, Jason Kidd, the coach of the Mavericks, had been saying, as Phoenix had, I think, run their winning streak against Dallas head-to-head to 11 straight through game two, dating back to the regular season, of course, Jason Kidd kept on saying that he needed someone else beyond Luka Doncic to join the party. And then Dorian Finney-Smith shows up, Davis Bertans adds in 12, Spencer Dinwiddie has 10 himself. And all of this is happening, and all of this is surprising to me. But post-game, Brian, it feels like the Suns were pretty obsessed with another theory as to why Chris Paul had been bothered by all of this, which is that the officiating was terrible. And Chris Paul, post-game, actually, like, talked to one of, like, the communication staffers, it seemed, and said, can I, like, leave this presser so I don't get fined? And then he did exactly that, and Devin Booker was left alone to take questions, and he was pretty clearly frustrated in what he said and also what he did not say about the referees.
Devin, what was the biggest talking point in the locker room to get ready to, A, finish this one and move on to game
time? We usually, you know, we let the dust settle, watch film as a team and regroup then.
Right. Well, Chris was also upset, apparently, by something that happened with several of his family members near the Suns bench.
Right, because Chris Paul tweeted post-game, quote, want to fine players for saying stuff to the fans, but the fans can put their hands on our families, ... F*** that. 2 exclamation points, referring to an alleged incident where some Dallas fans had apparently pushed his mom and his wife. And we're waiting for the video, but the Mavericks have said that a fan, at least, had been ejected due to, quote, unacceptable behavior.
Yeah, there was some video that surfaced where it looked to me like a teenage fan who was sitting in the row immediately behind the Suns bench was asked to be removed and got a good talking to from Chris Paul as he was removed. You know, one of the things about the current situation in arenas is there's literally tens of thousands of cameras. Whatever happened, I'm sure will be discovered, but it was very clear that Chris Paul was very upset by it. I know that the flopping epidemic has been going on in the NBA for years now, and the NBA has taken a sort of a stand against it for a while where they were issuing flopping fines. But it seems to me, just anecdotally, without having, you know, any sort of official flopping registry, in this playoffs and particularly in this second round, there's an immense amount of flopping going on. The series that I am with and covering right now, which is Milwaukee-Boston, I mean, again, this is not a new strategy, the idea of trying to bait Giannis Antetokounmpo into offensive fouls. The Celtics are falling down at a rate that you would almost want to re-examine their strength and conditioning program.
No, it's Brian, it is like stuntman level theatrics at this point. And I get it because it's working by and large.
Yeah, yeah.
Brian, you mentioned the series that you're covering in Milwaukee right now and all of the theatrics that are happening there. And I want to get to that with you right after this quick break.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Brian, you mentioned that you're in Milwaukee covering what I think, by the way, was the best game of the weekend, as much as I am a partisan for the Sixers, right? Because what you got with the Celtics and the Bucks now up 2-1 over Boston, was a legitimate thriller. It was 103-101. It was a game that also came with all sorts of post-game litigation. And I need you to just set this one up for us, Brian, because there are 5 seconds left. The Bucks are up 3, and Marcus Smart winds up with the ball beyond the arc. And what exactly happens here?
Yeah, it was the result of a broken play. The Celtics had gotten the ball back down 3 with 11 seconds left. They called a timeout and drew up a play. And something that was very apropos of what happened in that whole game, the Bucks defense smothered it. I mean, this series has been a study in tremendous defense. Both of these teams are excellent at it, and they are throwing their entire repertoire of defense at each other. And so the Bucks blew up the play, and it became a scramble. And Marcus Smart, realizing he was running out of time, went to just fling up a shot outside the three-point line, and Drew Holiday fouled him. And there was an official, a veteran official, Sean Wright, standing right there, couple of feet away, and he immediately signaled that it was a two-shot foul for being a rip-through move. In other words, a move where Marcus Smart was throwing his hands into Drew Holiday to force a foul, and that is a two-shot foul. It's a two-shot foul in the first quarter. It's a two-shot foul in the fourth quarter.
No, and this move is, by the way, a Chris Paul special. It's also a move that the NBA has told the ref specifically not to reward anymore in this new regime as they might have previously.
And it was a move that Marcus Smart did earlier in the game. and the foul happened right next to the Celtics bench, right next to Coach Ime Udoka, right a few feet from owner Wick Grusbach and team vice president Mike Zarin. And watching all of their reactions as Sean Wright, the official, announced that it was a two-shot foul, it was just like they were flabbergasted. And Marcus Smart's defense, and I have to admit, his defense was, why would I, you know, use a rip-through move knowing I'm only going to get two free throws for that when we are down three with 4 seconds to play? I'm not going to do that. The play was not reviewable. The Celtics had already used their challenge. But I'm going to tell you that it would not have been overturned in challenge, I don't believe. And the NBA, 24 hours later, in fact, upheld it as a correct call. But it certainly was a controversial call. And Marcus Smart ended up having the greatest intentional miss free throw I think I've ever seen.
No, Brian, this part, like, everybody tries to do this. He actually basically did it.
I would have probably given him 10 tries, and I don't think he could have done it as well again.
No, because you got to hit the rim, right, for it to count. And Marcus Smart does the two-hand push thing. He hits the backboard, it grazes the rim, and it caroms right back into his hands.
If you do that, you have to hit the rim.
And he does hit the rim. Smart got it, puts it up. No, tip won't go. Williams, another try. Horford, no. He tips it in, but it's afterwards. The game is over.
That's right. And the Celtics actually get three shots at it in that 4.5 seconds. They get three attempts at the ball up on the rim and it doesn't go in. And if it had gone in, Marcus had made the first free throw, so the tip in would have tied the game and forced overtime. Al Horford did finally make it a split second after the buzzer. It was the fourth time the Celtics got a ball up on the rim, though, in that 4 point whatever seconds. So taking a step back, Pablo, The Bucks are down Chris Middleton, who not only is their second best player, but a vital player in a series where the opposition, like the Celtics, has great wing players. So you lose your lead defensive wing when you have to deal with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, and not to mention your second leading scorer and your guy who's been incredibly clutch for you. And so for the Bucks to be up 2-1 with Middleton definitely out for game four, and, you know, still maybe too early to say for games five or six, but maybe, but not likely. The Bucks are in tremendous position to be up 2-1 under all these circumstances.
Yeah, and entering this game, right? Like, it's worth mentioning this. Giannis Antetokounmpo was not looking entirely like himself. I mean, he was shooting less than 40% from the field through the first two games of the series. He was struggling against Al Horford, against Grant Williams, oftentimes one-on-one, clearly missing Chris Middleton. And Mike Budenholzer, Brian, the coach of the Bucks, basically said what any coach, I think, honestly would say when you have Giannis, which is basically, you know, Giannis always figures things out. Which is an incredible thing to just count on your employee to save your ass like that.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what happened in this game.
Yeah, I mean, Giannis is just such, he's worth his weight in platinum in a postseason setting. And he, you know, in the first round, the Celtics held Kevin Durant, basically an indefensible player, to 38% shooting and 5 turnovers a game. It's one of the greatest team defensive performances I think I've ever seen in a postseason
Same.
Series.
Same.
And they come into the first two games in Boston, and granted, you know, the Bucks did win game one because they shot the ball tremendously off Giannis passes. First two games in Boston, Giannis, 38%, 5 turnovers a game, and frustrated. And I tell you, when I flew here to Milwaukee, seeing that six-game package of defense on Durant and defense on Giannis, I'm thinking this Celtics team might win this title because
they look like the favorite to me in the postseason because of that stuff.
And they still well might do it. But Giannis, from what I am told, just spent the 3 days in between games two and three just stewing over his performance and just, not only recovering, but just, laying in wait and preparing. And he just dropped a relentless masterpiece. And with 42 points and 12 rebounds and 8 assists and, it's always known in baseball that, great pitching will always be great hitting. I mean, we've seen it through the decades with a number of incredible players. Well, in the NBA, a singular offensive force can beat the greatest defense. We've seen it from Jordan to Kobe to Shaq to LeBron. And that's what we saw in game three. And, Giannis doesn't have the rounded offensive game that some of those other guys did. He still really needs to use brute force a lot or transition. Mm-hmm. He's actually shot the three-pointer abysmally. He's almost turned back the clock to his earlier part of his career in these playoffs. So I don't know if I can say he's going to be able to continue doing this. Also, it absolutely exhausted him. He was completely gassed by the final horn.
He assisted or scored on 61 of the team's 103 points.
Yeah. Yeah. So I it's hard for me to see, but when you have Giannis, anything is possible. And I'm feeling shades of LeBron here because I covered so many LeBron series against the Celtics. Well, it was in Cleveland, then Miami, then back to Cleveland. And there were times when the Celtics had the better team, but LeBron was so singularly dominant that he just willed his team to do it. And as I'm sitting in Boston watching a Sunday afternoon game one, where the Celtics were the better team, but Giannis was the better player and his a home court advantage is stolen, I'm like, I have been here before. And while they are different players, the concept of the way they win their team's games is very similar.
Yeah, there's a degree of unstoppability, if that's even a word, to Giannis when he's driving, when he's just, brute forcing his way to the rim. And the converse of this dynamic right now, Brian, is what's happening to Jason Tatum? Because the Bucks played game three. If Giannis figured out the Celtics, it feels like the Bucks figured out Jason Tatum. And I don't know what exactly you're seeing, but I'm curious because he had entered this postseason. He had entered this series, to be specific, in that conversation, or at least the outskirts of it, the conversation of best player in the world after outdueling Kevin Durant. But he goes 4-for-19 from the field in this game. He has just 10 points. He could not hit a three to save his life. What did they do to him? What did you see?
I'm a big believer in Jason Tatum. I know that's not exactly a hot take. I'm a big believer in him. And so it pains me to say that of the six halves that have been played in this series, five of them, he has not delivered, with the exception of the second half of game two, where he scored 23, 24 points and neutralized Giannis Antetokounmpo trying a comeback. Other than that, he just hasn't been the player that I expect him to be. You can't be this kind of player and not have an impact on the game. And there's a couple of things going on. Wesley Matthews, who's much smaller than Jason in terms of height, he's giving him problems. He's not allowing him to get to angles that he wants. He's not allowing him to get to spots. I don't think the Celtics are doing the best job of creating good situations for Jason. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if in game four they'd use screens a little bit more to get Wes Matthews off of him. But one of the things Ime Udoka said is, he just sees a lot of indecision. There are times when Jason is over-aggressive, where he dribbles into a situation where he can't get out of. And there are other times when he's, not aggressive enough. The final play, when the inbounds play completely broke down and the Celtics are scrambling and Marcus Smart is searching for some shot, Jason Tatum is standing, 30, 40 feet away just watching. And that's not acceptable. And I mean, I don't want to bring it down to one play, but he can't have a game like that at this. The Celtics are championship contenders. Jason Tatum is the type of player who in a month we could be talking about receiving the trophy, for the MVP trophy from Bill Russell. But that's not acceptable for him to play that way. And I'm holding him to a high standard because I believe he can hit it.
So, Brian, the last game that I wanted to talk to you about here is the one that was the least in doubt out of all of the ones we've discussed, but it's arguably the one that has the most bad blood running through it. Because the Warriors, look, they blow out the Grizzlies, 142-112, to take a 2-1 lead in this series on Saturday. But the result of it, the upshot of it, most pressingly, is simply that Ja Morant is now likely out for Game 4 on Monday night. So what happened on the play in question, Brian, as you understand it, as Ja Morant's postseason now is hanging in the balance?
Yeah, with the game already decided, you know, the Grizzlies were attempting to get something going. Ja Morant was trapped far away from the basket, and Jordan Poole, who is not a good defender but was trying to make a play on the ball, tried to reach in. And in real time, you know, I can't prove anybody's intent, but in real time, it looked like Jordan Poole was just slapping at the ball. In slow motion replay, it shows that Jordan catches Ja Morant's right knee and pulls at it, which twisted it. And Ja has been bothered by that right knee. Late in the season, he missed a couple of weeks with right knee soreness right at the end of the season. That is the same knee. Shortly before that Jordan Poole play happened, Ja bumped knees with Klay Thompson. I have no idea, but the Grizzlies say that on that play, he suffered an aggravation of that knee injury, and now he is doubtful for Game 4. And it's very upsetting that the Ja would be taken out by that. I would say that the Grizzlies in general, Pablo, they're very, very excited. They're very excitable. Even their coach, Taylor Jenkins, who I admire the work that he's done, and I voted him third on my Coach of the Year ballot. He has gotten excitable at times. And
excitable and finable, yes, at the same time.
And, you know, you sense, you know, I know that he has a history of coaching in the playoffs as an assistant, but you sense his inexperience too. And it is very upsetting that this series could end up be deciding by an injury that occurred on that play to Ja, because I really do believe without Ja, it's going to be very difficult for the Grizzlies to come back and win this series if he is indeed injured enough to be out. But it just, I think the Grizzlies in general need to, and they will. And I think, you know, maybe they don't feel it right now, but when they look back at this, they will realize that they are just too a little on edge, and they need to just really have a little bit more composure. And I know that specific thing isn't why Ja got hurt, but it is something that I think isn't necessarily always serving them well. Really, if you want to boil it all down, even though I know there's strategy on each side and there's guys making plays everywhere, in Game 2, the game the Grizzlies won in this series in Memphis, the Warriors were 7 of 38 on three-point shooting, one of the worst shooting games they've had in this era, one of the worst three-point shooting games for the Splash Brothers, and they lost that game by 5 points on the road. And almost predictably, quite frankly, they come back when they go home and they back up one of the worst shooting games they've ever had with one of the best shooting games they've ever had. And they go 17 of 32 and they win by 30. They are not a 7 of 38 and nor are they a 17 of 32, but that is really, you want to get down to the bedrock, and certainly you could break down X and O's about what Memphis may have done well in Game 2 that they didn't do well in Game 3. But ultimately, it comes down to, if the Warriors shoot like that, you're not going to beat them. And so I really hope that Ja can play. But you know, this is probably going to end up being a series that is more defined by the Warriors' execution than it is going to be by play calls or quotes or tweets.
When you score 142, Brian, everybody's doing great on your team, right?
That's right.
But the Grizzlies' dynamic is far more dire, right? Because, I mean, look, Ja, just to put a finer point on this, Ja Morant had been maybe the best player in the playoffs at this point, right? I mean, he's averaging 38, 8, and 7. And the thing about him, Brian, was that, like, the one thing the Warriors tried to give him was all the three-pointers that he wanted. That's his one offensive weakness, you might say. And he's been shooting, like, 43% on 10 attempts a game. And so take him out of the picture, and what are the Grizzlies left with?
Nothing, especially in a game where Dylan Brooks is suspended. Now, Dylan Brooks is a role player, but he's a scorer. And he has games where he can get very hot. And so without Ja and without Dylan, you know, it's going to be very hard for them to keep up. And not only that, but Desmond Bane, who's a vitally important player for them at both ends, he's been dealing with a back issue. He seems to be improving, and he had his best game of the series in game three. But they can't survive. I know that, you know, you can show the statistic that they were 20-5 during the regular season when Ja was out. And it's one of the reasons why I put Taylor Jenkins on my Coach of the Year ballot. But, you know, in the playoff setting, they can't survive without Ja. So I hope that the injury is really just, you know, more of a nagging thing and that he can play. It's, you know, if you're a Grizzlies fan, you're not going to like hearing this because your star player is injured. It's an unfortunate occurrence. It is, you know, I'm trying not to be mean here, but the fact that Taylor Jenkins would come out and basically lead the call for a suspension on a play that the NBA league office is like, it's just a regular foul.
The league office has already said they reviewed it. It's not anything beyond the ordinary.
It shows an immaturity that speaks to why it's going to be hard for the Grizzlies to continue going forward. And that immaturity is not a surprise. They are an extraordinarily young team. And this experience will pay off for them down the road. We have seen this many, many times where, I would not be surprised if in a year or two, the finals are being played in Memphis. But, you know, you saw in this last series where they beat the Minnesota Timberwolves, another very immature team with a head coach that is not experienced as a head coach in the playoffs. And you saw erratic play and erratic decision-making all over the place. So both of those teams will graduate on and look back, I suspect, at this and say, boy, were we out of our minds at that time.
Yeah, being out of your mind is also how I might look back on how I felt on the night that James Harden saved the Philadelphia 76ers. But until then, Brian Windhorst, I'm going to go celebrate, and thank you for joining us.
Enjoy it, Pablo. I don't know how often you're going to be able to, so savor it.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.